you have faith in me, or because you say it's not true, or get you all confused. One monk says one thing, somebody says something else. I always prefer to teach people the way to find out for themselves. And this is important, the whole path which I've been teaching here, letting go, making peace, being kind, being gentle, it's such an important path. Because number one, you experience that yes, this does feel like, you know, what Buddhism, religion, meditation actually is. It has the taste of freedom, as the Buddha would often say, the vimutti rasa. And you can sometimes, you may not see the whole picture, but you know that this tastes like it's freedom, it tastes like it's pure, it tastes like it's kind, the sort of thing which you would expect and intuitively you know must have something to do with the truth. And knowing that taste of freedom is really, really important, because that gets you deeper and deeper. It gives you confidence, as I said in that simile of the mist in the mountain. You're following this path down and you know you're pretty sure it's going to take you under the mist. And you come to that time when you do get under the mist, you can only understand why we do all these things. And especially this whole idea of anatta, non-self. The understanding of that is basic to the way we meditate here. Because as I think I mentioned in passing, but I'm going to reinforce it now. When you exert your will, when you really try hard to stop the mind thinking, to keep the mind still, to focus on the breath, or whatever else you're trying to focus on, whenever you exert the mind with willpower, you are strengthening your sense of self. Which is why that if you achieve something, you feel so proud, you feel so good. Yes, I'm a meditator. Yes, I've got jhana. Not like those other namby-pamby cream puffs who fall asleep all the time. You see that in some sort of situations. And it was a Tibetan monk who was really, really gross in other areas. He was smart in some areas where he started to notice in the United States what he called spiritual materialism. In the same way they have other types of materialism, see who's the richest, the famous, who's got the biggest house, the biggest car, the biggest salary, and who's got the best position in the company. You know that type of materialism which you see in the world. And he saw that transferring into religion or spirituality. You know, who's got the best jhana? Who can meditate the most? Who's the wisest? Who's the most enlightened? And you can start to see that spiritual materialism come when people really struggle and strive, when it's all about attainments. And apparently that some years ago in one monastery, I think it was in Burma, they gave actually certificates to people, stream winning certificates. So you're authenticated that you were a stream winner or once returned or not. So you had your on your wall next to your sort of your degree and next to your swimming certificate or whatever else you've got. And this is my enlightenment certificate. And when I heard that, there's something fundamentally wrong with that. And when you sort of go to a teacher like Ajahn Chah and say, this is not about attainments, it's about letting go. You see there's something fundamental there about letting go of the sense of self, letting go of the ego. Because when there's striving, yeah, there is attainments, so-called attainments. And then you get proud of your attainments, you get into spiritual materialism. But more often than not, you don't attain and then you get frustration, depression and lack of self-esteem, which is another part of self. The Buddha was very smart, well obviously very smart, insightful. He noticed there were three types of conceit, three types of ego. I only thought there was one, the ego, I am better. But he also noticed I am worse is another form of ego, another form of conceit. And that is, you know, when you're striven and you fail, you don't think you're good enough. That lack of self-esteem, that thinking you are inferior, thinking you are worse, you are no good, that is another form of conceit. Exactly the same as I am so good, I am the best meditator, I tell the best jokes, I am smart, whatever it is. That type of conceit is exactly the same as I am worse. And then you have the democratic conceit. We are all the same. That is another type of conceit. And that was really fascinating. The Buddha could see that, and it just opened up a lot of areas which I never understood before. That each one of these things, you are not the same. If you were the same, we'd only need one toilet, no male, no female, we can always go in the same one. Actually, there was a spiritual community, the orange people, that's what they did. They had just, toilet. They had actually an entrance for male, an entrance for female. But when they actually went in there, it was all going into the same room. And there was just this line of toilet bowls, no spaces in between. So, you sat next to anybody. That was weird. So we don't do that here. You are different. Okay. So, saying we're all the same is also conceit. Now, what we're doing to overcome that type of conceit, and all conceits, to understand this whole idea of like spiritual materialism, one-upmanship or one-lessmanship, sometimes this happens, is actually let go of all striving. The very cause which creates conceit, which creates the idea of success and how great you are, or because of striving, or which creates this lack of self-esteem and depression and feeling one is a failure. Now that's again from striving. And what happens when you don't strive? This is what meditation is all about. And what actually happens where you really get the great deep insights is understand when you don't strive, when you go for stillness rather than striving, you get peace. So you don't need attainments anymore. What do you need attainments for? What do you need to prove anything for? When you're at peace, you have everything you ever wanted. This, again, is part of the craving insight. It's wanting creates striving, which creates a sense of ego and self. And with the sense of ego and self, you're always eventually you'll fail. Every person, they strive, eventually you lose. Just like, in the Olympic Games, thousands and thousands of athletes went to the Olympic Games, but only, one person in every sport succeeded, and everyone else was a failure. Even if you come second, that's the worst failure of all, because you come so close, you just don't quite get it. And it's like one of the reasons I gave up, watching football. Because I was brought up in England, you always follow football teams. But then I realized that there was about 80 or 90 professional clubs, and only one would go top that year. And 89 clubs would be failures, and all their supporters would become depressed. And so the odds are against you having any fun and enjoying yourself. Whether you play the National Basketball League, or the Hockey League, or American football, no matter what team you support, most of the time they will lose. They have to. So you're just asking for suffering, supporting soccer, or supporting cricket. Look, there's many Sri Lankan people here. If you support cricket, now how many professional cricket teams are there? There's only about 7 or 8. So it's a much better team sport, to support, because you've got more chance of winning something, when there's only a few people play the sport. But even so, there's 8 teams means 7 years out of 8, you're not going to win at all. And that really is a lot of suffering. So how many times does the Sri Lankan cricket team win? They lose more matches than they win. So you're going to suffer much more than you're going to have happiness. So what are you doing it for? It's a waste of time. It's just suffering. Because that's whatever happens when you are into happiness through success and attainments. You're asking for suffering. You can succeed and go to the next level, succeed and go to the next level, but eventually you will lose. So you never get any happiness of that way. And even wanting things in the world, wanting wealth, you can want, but there's no end to that. And then you become like a little monk or a nun. And there you find the end of wanting. This is one of my important stories, which I love repeating to people. As a monk or a nun, We don't receive any money, no personal funds, please. Even if you think, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you really helped me out. Can I get something for you? Something personal. Don't do that, because I will say no. I don't want anything personal. And the reason is that many years ago, the first year, second year as a monk in Thailand, I'd helped somebody and they wanted to show their gratitude. And they knew the monastic rules. You can't give any money, but you can give personal gifts. So they came up to me and they said, "Now, you've helped me a lot, can we get you something?" And I said, "Not for the monastery, we give donations to the monastery, this is for you, just for you, Ajahn Brahm, no one else." And they usually give an amount, so you've got some understanding of what, you know, they're talking about. So they said, 100 baht, I put aside 100 baht for you, is anything you need for 100 baht? And this was about 35 years ago, 40 years ago, so it was actually quite a reasonable sum of money in those days in Thailand. And because you were a nice, peaceful monk, you just didn't know what you wanted. So I was thinking there and just saying, well, I'm not quite sure what I want. And a lay person, they've got work to do. They were getting quite sort of impatient with me. Can I ask for something quick? I've got to go. And so I had a good idea. I said, look, why don't you come back tomorrow at the same time? Give me some chance to think about what I need, and I'll come and tell you tomorrow. He said, good idea, see you tomorrow. And off he went. And that night, after the evening meditation and chanting, I sat down in the room of my hut and started thinking, what do I need for 100 baht? And then straight away, I was using this old candle, you know, to sort of, to write on, or to write with. So straight away, it's actually the piece of paper I used, this is no exaggeration, was the back of a mosquito coil cover, because we didn't have any paper. So I thought, well, I actually need an exercise book. And there's simple things, just to write things on. And I also, instead of using this candle, you know, I need actually a proper oil lamp. So I wrote the oil lamp down. And we know with an oil lamp, I need some matches. We're always running out of matches, and because it was the tropics, you get a box of matches, they soon get wet, and you can't strike them anymore. And you know, talking about sort of light, you know, my flashlight was just really sort of on the blink. You could hardly see anything. And you needed flashlights. There were snakes on those jungle paths. You always were seeing snakes. And without a flashlight, you'd step on them. So I put flashlight and some batteries. And already, 100 baht wasn't enough. And as I was thinking what I could strike off the list, and I also thought, my pen is not working, so I'd better get a new... I was actually using a pencil, I need a pen. And I could not take any of those items off. Because once I thought of them, I realized just how important they were, and actually how necessary they were. And the list was always getting longer, and I could not take any item off. And soon, 1,000 baht was not enough. And at that point, I realized what was happening. And I screwed up that piece of paper and threw it into a spittoon. And when that guy came the next day, I really scolded him. Don't you ever do that to me ever again. I was such a happy, content monk before you gave me 100 baht to spend. Now 100 baht wasn't enough. Please don't do that. And I never had that done to me again. And I realized this is what happens. Now, when you start desire, everything on your list is really important. And you wondered how you could ever live without it before. And however much you have, it's never, ever enough. That's the nature of desire. You know that. Doesn't matter how much money you have, it's never enough. Doesn't matter what salary you have at work, you can always do with some more. Doesn't matter how much stuff you have in your house. And these days, they have these storage units, so you can store stuff in another place. Doesn't matter how many rooms you have in your house, it's never big enough. No matter how many spiritual attainments you have, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, it's not enough, I want fourth jhana. Isn't that the case? Wanting just leads to more wanting. And when I was didn't have any opportunity. I was such a happy monk. When I had no money at all, I literally wanted for nothing because I couldn't get anything. So he gave up wanting. And I realized that whole statement, to want for nothing, is usually attributed to very, very wealthy people. They got so much money they want for nothing. But if you go and see some wealthy people, it's not that they want for nothing. They keep wanting for a lot more. Only the monks and nuns, or you guys, who know some peace in your mind, want for nothing. Now you're peace, now you're content, now you're free. So now you understand why all week I've asked you, please want for nothing. Stop all this wanting business and just be. And discover you are richer, more wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. Already you have enough, you have this moment. So you see, when you're not wanting, you're letting go. And what's disappearing is your desires and cravings. And you're finding contentment, peace at last. And surprise, surprise, to find peace, you don't need very much at all. You've got your little room and ensuite, such a small house you're living in. Wouldn't that be wonderful if when you got home, that's the size of your abode too. Just a little room with an ensuite. And a communal kitchen where you can come and get some good food every day. What more do you want in life? So simple, so free. So what we're actually teaching here is just very, very profound. It's not just how to meditate. It's just how to be free. How to be peaceful. How to be richer beyond your wildest dreams. With nothing at all. And as you do let go of this wanting business, also you're letting go of this idea of the sense of self, which is one of the reasons this meditation becomes quite scary at times. Have you ever noticed that when you start to get into deep meditation, you have fear? And all fear is about losing something. Every time you get afraid, it means something you're attached to is being taken away from you. That's what you're afraid of. But what you really are letting go of is nothing which is worth keeping. It's just another burden, just another sack of rocks you're carrying on your back. And you know that because every time you do let go, you go through that fear. You feel so peaceful, you feel so free, you feel so blissful. But what you're really letting go of is all your possessions which define who you are, letting go of your controller and allowing all to disappear, letting your body vanish, letting your will vanish. And that's the scariest thing of all, where this thing which guards and protects you, the thing which you expect to be the vehicle which gets you what you want in life, the will, when you start to see that disappearing, that's the scariest thing of all, to see the thing you call the will stop. Remember, whenever the will is active, that lake will always have waves on the surface. You're always doing something, that's why you never have stillness. But going for stillness, another word for that, is you're letting go of your will. Allowing it to vanish. That's why it is very scary, meditation. And that's also why many people have difficulty meditating. Yeah, you know the instructions, and you have enough confidence, I hope, by now, to know this actually works. This creates peace and happiness and bliss, and you have a great time. You see beautiful nimittas, get into jhanas when you stop controlling. But it's scary stuff. Because when your controller, your doer, disappears, everything you thought you were also vanishes as well. And this is where you get the really, really powerful insights. So let's go back to how this works once more. In a simile which I often give, and sometimes I create a whole talk on this, but I'm just going to do this as part of this talk. The simile of meditation called the thousand-petaled lotus simile. A lotus is closed up at night time, And if you look at a lotus when it's closed up, the outermost petals have no scent. And they are not beautiful. They've got no color, they're rough, they're coarse, and they're dirty. But when the first light and warmth of the sun comes in the morning, the outermost petals opens up, and inside that rough, dirty, coarse outermost layer of petals, which protects the inner petals, you see the first layer of real petals. There's some fragrance there, they're quite beautiful, but they're still quite thick and coarse. But that allows the sun, the warmth and light of the sun, to hit that next layer of petals so they can open up, so the layer of petals inside of it can receive the light and warmth from the sun and then open up in turn. The layers of petals of the lotus open up one after the other. When one has opened up, the one inside can now receive the warmth and light of the sun and it can open up. And the deeper you go into the lotus, the more beautiful are the petals, the more delicate they are and the more fragrant they are. And that is a very accurate simile to meditation. When a person starts meditating, this old body, it is like the outermost petal of a lotus closed up at night time. And you never ever expect, you know, in this body and mind of yours, to think there's incredible beauty and bliss and enlightenment right in its center. In the same way that if you didn't know what a lotus was and saw this hard bud in the morning, you never believe there's such beautiful, fragrant flowers inside. So when people say, can everyone become enlightened? I answer, can every lotus open up? Has every lotus got beautiful fragrant petals inside? Of course they have. They just need to open up, that's all, to find those beautiful petals. And in that simile, the warmth and light of the sun stands for mindfulness and kindness. The light of mindfulness, the warmth of kindness. Which is why if you can just shine mindfulness and kindness on your body, start off with, just be aware of this body and be kind to it. You get so comfortable and cozy, it's not a problem anymore, and it disappears. It opens out to reveal the next layer of petals, which is your mental world. If your body has aches and pains, it's tired, it's causing you problems, it's not relaxed, of course you can't attend to the mental world. The body takes precedence. So by being mindful and kind of the body, it opens up and you see what's inside, your mental world. And in that mental world, as first layer of petals, it's still quite rough and coarse, but you just have mindfulness and kindness onto this mental world. And that opens up and you come into the present moment, right in the center of time. And now that is already a very beautiful layer of petals. Just to be in this moment now, which is in the center of your mind. Your mind's opened up, now you're in the present moment. And all you need to do there is be mindful and kind. And then you're in the present. And if you're mindful and kind of the present moment, what happens next? It opens up and you're in the silent present moment. Right in the center of now, as I've said already, there's no space to say anything. I gave a simile in one of my meditation books, so like a host at a party. You're greeting the visitors as they come into your party. And if you're greeting a visitor and have a conversation with them, you're missing the people coming in behind. You miss them. You can't have a conversation, just shake the hand and go on to the next one. Shake the hand, go on to the next one. Shake the hand, go on to the next one. Now that's like the stream of present moments. If you are really in the present moment, you can't have a conversation with it. In other words, you have to be silent to attend to every present moment. Even noting it, you know, heat, cold. In just the time you've said heat or noted it to yourself, you've missed so many other present moments. So to really be in the center of the present moment, you're in silence. It just happens naturally. And that is far more beautiful and fragrant than the present moment itself. And as I mentioned to many of you, when you're in the present moment, you're just kind and peaceful and kind and mindful to this present moment. Because everything is starting to settle down and disappear, everything which is still eventually vanishes. That's the nature of stillness. The brain can only notice things which move. Even the aircon has been turned on every now and again. When the aircon is turned on, my goodness, it makes a noise. You can notice it when it's first turned on. But after a couple of minutes, because it's constant, you don't notice it anymore. The brain only notices things which change. So the same with the stillness. The body is still, no thinking because you're silent, no past or future. The only thing left which moves is your breathing. That's why the breath comes up naturally. So right in the center of silence, when silence opens up, the next layer of petals is your breath. And it happens naturally, it's right inside, it's just a level of stillness, a level of letting go. And what do? You're just mindful and kind. Don't forget the kindness. It's not just the light of the sun, it's the warmth of the sun opens up the petals. And that's all you need to do, which is actually doing nothing at all. You know, being mindful, being kind. Kindness, real kindness, is a passive act. You're opening the door of your heart and accepting whatever it is with love and no discrimination. May all beings be happy and well, admitting, well, I'm not going to say that word. May all beings, may all experiences be happy and well. So loving kindness is without discrimination. And this is why loving kindness is an act of non-doing, non-discriminating, non-judging, and accepting. So that's why if you have loving kindness, this beautiful kindness and mindfulness towards your breath, it becomes very still. And as it becomes still, as I mentioned, the mindfulness increases, and so you actually start to see the full awareness of the breath. The breath petal opens up and you come into the full awareness of the breath, from the beginning to an end. It just happens naturally. And as you're watching the full awareness of the breath, that opens up, you're just mindful and kind all the way through, mindful and kind, that opens up to the delightful breath. The delightful breath is right in the middle of the full awareness of the breath. You're watching this delightful breath, and that opens up, and you see this incredible nimitta, the lights. And you just watch the nimitta. What should I do when I get the nimitta? Keep the warmth and light of the sun shining on the nimitta. Just be mindful and be kind. Nothing else needs to be done. And eventually the nimitta opens up and there you get into the first jhana. What do you do to get into the second jhana? Same thing. The warmth and the light of the sun. Mindfulness and kindness. Don't forget the kindness. And the first jhana opens up and you're in the second jhana. And the third jhana. You always go deeper and deeper in. Just like the layer of petals in a lotus. Now what happens when you get into those deep layer of petals? They're not only just fragrant, they're not only just beautiful, that they are different. Because things which were there before are no longer there. That's why they are weird states. Already many of you have experienced weird states. Which is why I encourage you to enjoy weirdness. Weirdness is cool. Life can be so boring, same old stuff, but weird stuff, yeah, that rocks. So when anything weird happens, just go for it, because you become more adept at weirdness. Because when you get into the jhanas, these things are really weird. Like you've never experienced before. And if you don't know how to embrace the weird, then you may get scared at the entrance. So don't you like weird stuff? For me, I always used to like to go to weird movies when I was a kid. Anything scary or anything which was strange, I'd be the first to go up there. And it also meant that when things started to disappear and go to places I'd never been before, that was interesting. Even as a monk, I loved doing weird stuff. You know, things. That's one of the reasons I accepted an invitation to go to Las Vegas. Now that's cool. A monk going to Las Vegas. I wonder what I'm going to do there. That's why I had all these other, I get very busy sometimes and get all these invitations. I go and teach a retreat here, give a talk there. You know, quite frankly, I've done that so many times, it's boring. So, but when it gets an interesting invitation, like a couple of years ago, to give a keynote address at the World Computer Conference that was held in Brisbane, I thought, wow, I know nothing about computers. This will be great. So if it's something I don't know anything about, I'd love doing stuff like that. Or the other thing which I did some years ago, it was one of our members over here, he was a radio producer. And he said, look, I just produced many programs for, I think it was 6PR, you know, one of the local radio stations here. And he said, you get all these JoJos come and do talk back, and they're really hopeless. You know, you've really got something to say. Why didn't you come onto one of my talk back stations? So yeah, I'll do that. No, that sounds fun. I've never done that before. You know, go into a radio studio and take questions live and on air. So, you know, that whatever you say is recorded and everyone can hear it. And if it's something really weird, then you're really in stuff because it's there on tape. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. But, you know, it's so busy. It's very hard to find the time. I said, look, I'm in town every weekend. How about like Friday or Saturday night? And he said, yeah, Friday night. So after the Friday night talk, come to the studio at 10 PM and we'll put you on a talk back. So I said, yeah, great. So after the Friday night talk, like usual, lots of people. It's really weird when you ask for questions on a Friday night talk at Nolomara, hardly anyone puts their hands up. They've got no questions. So then we bow, and then there's a whole line of people want to ask their questions. But anyway, so there's a whole line of people. I had to rush off, and I only got to the studio literally about 1 or 2 minutes before they were going to go on air. So there's no chance to sort of say anything, just rushed into the studio, and put the headphones on, you know, right in front of the microphone, and then the MC of the show sort of welcomed the listeners. Welcome this evening to our show, and this evening we are very grateful to have two guests, and first of all, you know, no time to actually to get his tongue around my name, Brahm. So, you know, he did call me Mr. Monk. We have Mr. Monk, you know, the Abhayana Monastery. And our second guest this evening is Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, who is the author of many books on sex and other adult themes. When they said that, that's when I thought, oh my God, what show am I on? And it was 10 PM at night on a Friday. It was an adult show where people, because she was apparently, I found out later, she was the expert in Australia, the go-to person on sexual matters, you know, and sexual misfunctions or dysfunctions. You have problems in bed. She's the one who will answer your questions. And I was fielding questions all night on sex and relationships. And that was really fun. And I'd been a monk for about 30-odd years, celibate. But the strange thing was, and this is absolutely true, that after a couple of, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, now the callers could call in, and they had a choice who they would ask a question to, Dr. Gabriel Morrissey or Mr. Monk. And they were all asking Mr. Monk. And this expert was just literally just getting bored out of her skull because obviously the answers I gave were far more direct and far more interesting than the expert's view on things. Which really, you know, showed you when you really understand about meditation, about the mind, you understand everything. And what was the other thing that happened? I'm just really going off now. So, you know, I got all the questions. And look, actually, this is one of the questions I always remember. And it gives you an idea about how, you know, if you've got insight, if you really understand how the mind works, how you can give really good answers. One of the best answers I gave, a taxi driver called in, because, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night, the taxi driver's waiting for fares. You know, they tune into these programs. And he asked a question on his telephone. He said, I'm having an affair with a beautiful girl, my wife doesn't know. Is this okay? And they said, ask the experts. And so straight away, I said, sir, if it was okay, you would not be ringing me up to ask. And he slammed the phone down. You nailed him. Because this is actually, why do people ask these questions? Because they want some expert to say it's okay. And they know damn well it's wrong. And that's all they asked me for. They knew it was wrong, but they wanted me to say it was right. So I said, if it was right, you wouldn't be ringing me up to ask. And he hung up straight away. So look, when you really have that insight, you know, and as a monk, if anything interesting like that, I really love doing, because, you know, you get a bit bored doing the ordinary stuff and you want to test yourself and just extend to see where you're going. But I don't know how I got onto this bit about insight, but anyway, when you go back to just watching the breath and going into the things disappear. And that's one of the interesting parts of meditation. From stillness you get disappearing. For those of you who know your Pali, from samadhi we get viraga. Viraga is this word. Sometimes they call it dispassion. That is one reason, one rendering of it, but it also means things fade away. They disappear. And that is one of the most interesting parts of meditation, because when they disappear, then you understand what they really are. And there's a standard simile which I always bring out for every retreat, and the simile of the tadpole and the frog. It's a great simile because it's accurate, just like the thousand petal lotus. The simile of the tadpole and the frog works like this. So once there was a little tadpole, and she was born in this wonderful lake. She was a very intelligent tadpole. And she went to school, and she went to university, and she even became a nun, this little tadpole. And at university, she learned all about water, you know, this chemical composition and what it does. And when she was a nun, she even studied the Abhidhamma on water, what its nature was. But even though she was one of the highly, most intelligent tadpoles in the whole lake, and she had a PhD in hydraulics, could the little tadpole understand what water really was? No more than a fish could understand what water is. It can't, because the water has always been surrounding it ever since it was born. It's known nothing else except being in water. So with all of the philosophy and all of the education, you still can't understand what water is. But one day, little tadpole sprouted legs and arms. She became a frog. And one day, little frog, just playing around, and play is really important, playing around, jumped out of the lake. And when she was outside of the lake, that was weird. At first she was afraid of jumping out of the lake, because she'd never done that before. She thought it was scary. She thought she'd go crazy. She thought that science can't be right. But she did it. She jumped out of the lake. And that was the strangest experience she'd ever had. Totally unlike anything else she'd experienced. Because something was missing. Something which had always been there had now vanished. And that was water. And now little frog could understand, ah, that's what water is. All these teachings I've heard from these other old frogs in the brown robes who come and teach in the lake every now and again. All these teachings that water is wet. What do you mean water is wet? I can't understand that. No more than you little tadpoles can understand there's no self. What do you mean there's no self? That's rubbish. What does that mean at all? Of course I'm here. Look, I'm here, okay? No, you can't understand that until one day, you little tadpoles sprout legs and arms. You sprout limiters and you jump out of the lake and enter jhanas. Wow, that's scary. But if you're playful, you'll do that. You know how playful means you do things you're not supposed to do? You know, you sort of chant in weird ways, like I keep on doing. Do sadhus like no other monk has ever done before. Playing around. Because playing around is where you have adventure. Where you go to places you've never gone before. Do any of you remember Star Trek? Remember they what they used to say? To boldly go where no one has gone before. I know they said boldly, but I always change it. To boldly go where no one has ever gone before. You've got it, yeah. That's so playful and adventurous. It's important. That means you get into these nimittas and jhanas because you're just messing around and having fun, going to places you've never been before. When you get into those jhanas, this is weird. Your body has disappeared. No legs, no arms. You can't feel anything. You can't hear anything. Now you know what hearing is. What seeing, smelling, tasting, touching. Now you have an idea what your body really is. You think you know what the body is. Some of you have done PhDs and are doctors. But do you really cut up other people's bodies? You've seen them inside, but do you really understand what your body is? How can you, when all of your life you've had a body surrounding you? But when your body totally vanishes, which it does in meditation, in the jhanas, now you have an understanding of what the body truly is. It's not mine after all. And it's not much fun having a body. We always think it's great fun having a body. I can go here and go there, see the Great Wall of China, have really incredible sex, take drugs and get really high, go and see sunsets, see the birth of your first child. What is the most beautiful thing you've done in the world of the five senses? You leave those five senses aside when you realize all of it sucks. Even the very best sucks. Now that really changes your whole idea. When you find out, when this body disappears, now you are free, now you are happy. You realize that this body is like a prison. Because you've lived all your life in prison, you really think the prison is fun. And all your friends are in prison as well. And they all say it's fun. And you get these weird guys, these monks and nuns, who come and say, "Ah, come on, you're in prison." And you say, "Those monks and nuns, get a life. Come on, why are you monks and nuns? Why can't you have sex? Why can't you watch movies? Why can't you eat what you like? You know, you're crazy guys. Why do you do this to yourself?" And I also say, "Why do you do that to yourself? Having sex? Why do you do that to yourself?" Why do you put yourself in prison all the time? That's why monks, we are the most radical people. We ask the toughest of questions. We undermine everything you ever thought, which was fun and happy and truth and everything else. We're the most rebellious. That's why, one of those other weird things I did, which I accepted, was to give a speech at the gay pride breakfast in Perth many years ago. Again, I've never done that before. Because I'm not gay, I'm not heterosexual, I'm celibate. And so when I went to the gay pride breakfast, it was held in Curtin University over here some years ago. When I got the invitation, "Yeah, I've never done that before, yeah, I'm in." Again, anything weird I'll accept. So I went to the gay pride breakfast, and when other people gave their talks, my talk was, "Now you think you're weird. You know, you gay people. Gay people is natural these days. It's accepted. Now, being gay is ordinary these days. But being celibate, now that's weird." And I said that these days, gay people, gays, transsexuals, lesbians, you all have your rights these days. But the one group of people who are still discriminated against is we celibates. Still people say celibacy is not natural. Just like they said gay was not natural years ago. Now they say celibacy is not natural. So I said, "The next time we have a gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, I want a float for celibates." a celibacy float. Why not? That'd be a good idea. The monks and nuns, you can all come along on my float in a game that's been Mardi Gras. Because that's one thing people think is weird. Okay, gay sex is all right, ordinary sex, but no sex at all when you're really crazy. So that's why, you know, you're really challenging people when you become a monk and understand these things, but of course you can't believe that. But you get into jhanas and you start to see something different. All those teachings of the Buddha, which you can just maybe accept in theory, are right there in front of your face. Water was wet. Now you can understand that. Five senses are suffering. You can't understand that until the five senses have disappeared. That's why these jhanas are absolutely necessary. What about non-self? There's no one in here. Yeah, sure. What do you mean? Look, I'm here, okay? That doesn't make any sense at all. So don't try and philosophize on non-self. You will never get anywhere. You can have all your theories and thoughts and philosophies, but again, they're just not worth anything. They're not worth the brain they're thought on. Now, what happens is, especially in, say, a second jhana, something else disappears. Something which has always been there and now is no longer there. You know what disappears in the second jhana? That is your will. The ability to choose, to do anything. That now has totally vanished. That is the sign of second jhana, third or fourth jhana. You're stuck. You're frozen. You're like a rock. You're like a diamond. You can't do anything. Nothing is moving at all. That is the first time the lake is perfectly still. Not even a microscopic ripple on its surface. It's totally still. And because it's still, or the reason it's still, the consequence why it's still, is because this thing called will and choice has totally disappeared. It's not there anymore. And that is weird. It's also incredibly scary. I think in Dante's Inferno, this Italian writer and philosopher, he was the one who coined the words on the gates of hell, "Give up hope, all they give up hope, all ye who enter here." That's what happens in jhanas. Give up hope, will, desire, craving, everything disappears. And for many people that was scary stuff. But in Buddhism it's freedom. To know what this will truly is, this thing which controls you, the doer. To see what it's like when that totally vanishes. Yeah, of course there are times when you decide not to exert your will. There are times when you just don't sort of start your choice. But it's always there for you. Whenever you want, you can always do something if you choose to do it. But imagine that that's totally taken away from you. It's just not there anymore. It's vanished. Just like water has vanished for the frog. Then you understand what water is. This is the thing which happens in the second jhana and above. Even the first jhana, you can usually infer it because most of the will is gone. You realize what this will truly is. And it comes to non-self and who you think you are. That is 80-90% of who you think you are. The person in charge of your life. The will, the controller, the doer, the chooser, that's really who you identify with. That's why sometimes you get really frustrated and you get disappointed and depressed, because your will is stupid. And you take that on board, you think it's a personal responsibility. I've made bad choices in my life. You haven't made bad choices. The choice has got nothing to do with you. Other times you think you're so good and so proud, you've made really good choices, now look at me. So see how successful I am, because I made good choices. And you identify and own this thing called will. When you see what it truly is, number one, you find out it doesn't belong to you. It's nothing to do with you at all. And also you find, after you've experienced the second jhana, you know what the will truly is. It is enemy number one of your happiness. never allows you to be still and enjoy life. Even when you're on holiday, the world keeps making you check your mobile phone, check your SMSs. Always makes you do something. You go on holiday, what do? You go shopping, you play sports. Someone once told me, they gave me a brochure on Club Med somewhere. And I couldn't believe all the things you have to do every day in Club Med. They don't give you a moment's peace. It's some like tennis tournament, scuba diving, explore the reefs, shopping trips, and in the evening some sort of nightclub. You're active all day from the moment you get up. What type of holiday is that? And you have to pay a fortune for it as well. The real Club Med, you know where the real Club Med is? Yeah, you know, Club Med, Jhana Grove, Club Meditation. Now that's where you can really have a bit of peace. But why is it that when you've got nothing to do, you can't stop doing things? This retreat is a good example. All week you've had nothing to do at all. You could sleep as much as you want. You could just go for walks, read a book. And how many of you have all these things you've been doing? You've even been doing meditation instead of just sitting here and doing nothing. Trying to get somewhere. Trying to be peaceful. Trying to do this. Trying to do that. All your life is trying to get somewhere. Trying to do something. Trying to be somewhere other than you already are. Why is it so hard to do nothing? Because this will never give you a moment's peace. Just like in prison, it's the sadistic prison guard. You lay down, get up! You sit down, walk! You have a few moments rest, go! Do this, do that, come on, don't be lazy, you must do something, you must get somewhere. People need you, you've got to find out what your kids do, you've got to find out what your mother's doing, you've got to do something, make something useful in life. Don't just sit there, do something, blah, blah. That's your whole life. Always on the move. Restlessness. Why are you restless? Because will is always telling you to do something. When you understand what this will truly is, you understand what I keep teaching you. Stop striving. Stop trying to get somewhere. Like an Ajahn Chah, just sit under the Bodhi tree or the mango tree. That's how the mangoes fall, not by shaking them. Somehow or other, we've got to trick our will just to go to sleep, just to take their eyes off the ball for a few moments so you can be still and find out what this will truly is. When you understand what it truly is, it is not yours. It is totally conditioned, doesn't come from you, it's out of control. So after a while you just let it go. Not only do you get great insight into things like non-self, you also understand why we meditate in this way. Why all striving goes against the goal of peace. All letting go, kindness, making peace, is the path not only to get into jhanas, but the path to understand what is the obstacle to peace. What keeps you moving, and what will get you reborn when you die. The only reason why you get reborn is because you want to get reborn. You keep on going. Will never lets you stop. It won't let you stop now, just to relax and have peace in this jhana grove, and it won't let you stop when you die either. Always keeps you on the move. From experience to experience, from moment to moment, day to day, life to life. Will is a problem. Craving is the cause of suffering, said the Buddha. Letting go of craving, letting go, being peaceful, is the cause of nibbana. It is nibbana. Things stop. So that's why it really is necessary. Unfortunately, but it's true, you have to get these jhanas. If you don't get the jhanas, you won't be able to understand what your body is, what will is, let alone what consciousness is. The consciousness is what starts to vanish next in the jhanas. If you want to understand a good definition of jhanas, it's letting go of everything, stages of letting go. When the body is let go of and it disappears, when you let go, they disappear. When the body disappears, that's first jhana. When will disappears, that's second jhana. And for the rest of all those jhanas, the consciousness starts to vanish. The thing which knows starts to disappear. Ah! That's me who is going. No, it's not. When these things disappear, when you get to be a frog, you understand even that which knows, the mind, consciousness, that doesn't belong to you either. That's just this empty process. That's not who you are. Because it vanished. That's the only way you know what water is, when you're standing on dry land. It's the only way you know what consciousness is, when it starts to vanish. So these are where you get the real big insights. This is where you understand what Buddhism really is. They say about non-self, they say about suffering, they say about even impermanence. You know what impermanence means? It does not mean rise and fall. A person sits by the lake, they see the waves, they see the water go up, the water go down, the water go up, the water go down. Any Jojo can see that. That's not profound stuff. What real impermanence is when you sit down there by the lake and you get so still. Yeah, you see the waves go up, the waves go down. Until you get so still, the lake disappears. And all the trees and the hills behind it and the sky above it also vanishes. And it's not supposed to disappear. You think you're going crazy, but no, that is impermanence. Something which was always there stops being there, vanishes. That is impermanence. That's why if you carry on in this type of retreat, you would experience some weird stuff. But don't worry, you're not going crazy. Unless Ajahn Brahm is crazy. And maybe some of the jokes he says, maybe he is crazy. Now you know me, I'm a good monk. But you don't go crazy. You actually become enlightened instead. Real insights, real wisdom. You don't get real wisdom just by listening to a talk. You don't get real insight just by reading a book. You get real insight when you get this massive kick up your bum and you see things in a totally different way than you've ever seen before. Yeah, it's shocking. But if you really are committed to the truth, you're willing to sacrifice everything. All your old ways of doing things, seeing things, looking at things. Because it's true. So, this is how enlightenment happens. These are the big insights. This is what non-self really is. Not some sort of theory. But just what you see, what you experience when you go into the deepest of meditation. And don't think now, oh my God, I don't want to do this. You know, this is too much for me. I don't want to be sort of freaked out by seeing things disappear. I want to be, I'm sorry everybody, but it's now too late. You should have left earlier. Because now you've heard these teachings, you can't forget them. The seeds in your mind. And like it or not, one day you're going to get into those jhanas. And one day or not, when you're in those jhanas, say, oh my God, this is right, this is true. There wasn't anybody here. And not only do you understand the way of meditation, of letting go, you also have let go. And you too are free. And one of the noble ones. Well done. So you want to be free? This is how it happens. So there we go. A nice deep talk for you today with a few funny stories about talking about adult themes and a talk about radio show. And also some very powerful stuff as well. So I hope you enjoyed that. Is there any question why we're here? You got one? Oh, okay, go on. That's right, that's the last little echo of will. It's just the mind is still moving. It's totally automatic, so it's not sort of deliberate, it's just the last little thing which is left. That's why it's so little that even in the first jhana, most of the thing you recognize as will has vanished. Incredibly still. And that's also one of the reasons why people get into these jhanas, they just can't get out. They can't get out because there's nothing to get you out. You can't decide. You're in there and that's it. That's why these are weird states. Now, right now you're in control. If you don't like the talk, you can get out, you can ask a question, you can move anything. But imagine, everything, all your means of control, all your levers, are just not there anymore. Nothing to do, you can't do anything. All the levers of control have vanished. No mouse, nothing to click, no keyboard. No steering wheel, no pedals. So you can't do anything. You know that's very nice. It's very beautiful to be at peace at last. So if you really want to know what peace is, you just haven't touched the surface yet. You go to these jhanas and that's real peace. Peace upon peace upon peace. That's why it's really cool stuff, this meditation. Really have a great time. So hopefully that will be you. Have a great time, become enlightened at the same time. And some other people, what are the dangers of meditation? There is one danger of meditation. You won't go crazy. No, that's not a danger. The main danger of meditation is many people, they get into these jhanas and they tend to lose their hair. That is the main danger. Some of you are already losing your hair, so you've got nothing to worry about. Go on, go on.
When you go to the third jhana, then the consciousness disappears.
Yeah, it's not disappeared yet, it's disappearing. It takes to the immaterial jhanas to really go.
So after that, can you come back and live as a normal?
You can come back and live, but not the same person. You've just actually seen something which very few people can ever see. And just that, and it's just right in front of you. Sometimes many people can miss it. You know, they just get, wow, what was that? It's crazy. And they just put it in the too hard basket. Just like I think last night I said about that lady from Penang who got into a jhana. She just hadn't got a clue what it meant. It was weird, strange. But if you've been fortunate enough to listen to the Buddha's teachings, and to get this incredible, beautiful framework, exactly what's going on, so you have the experience and you know what it means, now you're going to get something. So if you want to be a soul one, a once returner, non-returner, arahant, this is how it works. So you will come back different. So be careful. You may lose your hair. Okay, let's do some interviews now. So have a beautiful morning. Don't be afraid. Because sometimes when I talk like this, people get really terrified. Oh, I don't want to become enlightened yet. I'm getting married next week. Don't worry about that. Just it will happen anyway. Okay, so have a nice morning. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Remember, this afternoon, interviews start at 2:00.